Circuit. We're ready for argument in our first case, U.S. versus McLean. Mr. Hall, be glad to hear from you.
Good morning. May it please the court, for the record, my name is Mark Hall, and I represent Roland McLean in this appeal. The issue, and there is really only one issue on appeal here, is whether or not my client's previous conviction for a battery in the state of Maryland would qualify him as a career offender for purposes of his sentencing in U.S. District Court. Of course, the federal sentencing guidelines and federal law provides us with the definition of a crime of violence, one that...
Paul, you may want to start with the motion to dismiss, because you've got to make it past that first.
I'll be happy to move to that point. The motion to dismiss was filed by the government in this case because of the waiver that was included as part of the plea agreement, and in fact, a substantial portion of the government's brief was devoted to that. I also received yesterday a further letter and from the government, including a case, Dickerson, which was recently handed down by this court concerning waiver. And I would suggest to the court there's really two points I'd like to make in regard to the waiver in this case. First of all, it's our position that since the objection was to the battery conviction was made in this case prior to the sentencing, that the issue is still ripe for decision by this court, despite the fact that there was a waiver. There was a change in I would suggest, the law in regard to examining this type of conviction because of the Johnson case. And as a result of that, and it's something that I don't believe would necessarily have been apparent at the time that the plea was entered into in this case, that Mr. McLean should be in a position to have that conviction discounted or not considered by the trial court in reaching a sentence in this case. The other point about the waiver is specifically in regard to the language that was used in the waiver itself in the plea agreement. It specifies 262 to 300 and some months as being the point of the waiver. I would point out to the court, though, that because of the sealed supplement in this case and the 5K, as long as the defendant did what was required under the sealed supplement, that the amount of 262 months as the bottom of those guidelines was never actually in consideration as a likely sentence in his case. So I would suggest to the court that the waiver is modified by the sealed supplement. And yes, Your Honor.
These circumstances arise frequently. I know from my own experience, and common sense tells us. Did you, I'm asking you a two-part question. Did you, in this case in particular, ever see any of the backup documents supporting the battery conviction in this case before the plea agreement? Is one part of the question. And the second part is, in general in Maryland, our defense counsel, given the evolution of Taylor and Shepard and all of those cases, Johnson, are defense counsel now taking the time to examine the underlying documentation before they recommend stipulations to career offender guidelines?
Well, insofar as the first part of the court's question, which involves specifically this case, the information that counsel would have had at the time that the plea agreement would have been entered into would have been the Basically, the convictions which were listed in the report that was prepared by Pretrial Services. And
right, and I don't mean to put you in a difficult position.
No, I understand that.
But a battery conviction, I mean, everybody's known in Maryland since at least Kirksey, I think, that a mere battery conviction without knowing more won't satisfy the guidelines or the armed career criminal. You got to go behind a battery conviction, right?
Right.
Got to go behind an assault second-degree conviction. So my question is, and again, I'm not trying to be difficult, frankly, but when lawyers recommend to their clients, you got to sign this stipulation because you are a career criminal. You've got this conviction. Do you have the underlying documentation?
In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. And I can tell the court that if a conviction is old enough, it is sometimes difficult to obtain.
And if it's old enough, it won't matter.
Well, if it goes to a certain point, it is. But even cases in such as this case, and I mentioned in the at some point in the either the brief or I believe it was actually my argument before Judge Quarles that ended up having to go to the state archives in order to get that copies of the documents that underlie the.
And are those documents now in existence? Have you seen them?
Yes, I have seen them in this case. I can tell the court that they're not always in existence, but I'm satisfied in this case that they were.
Yeah. And do you think if you had a do-over, would the government win or would you win?
Under
Kirksey and Sims and those cases?
I think that, that goes back to the primary issue in the appeal. I think that if we went back to square one in this case, that I believe it would be clear that the battery conviction should not have scored, and that were the government willing, as part of a plea agreement, to offer a plea that did not include that particular provision of the waiver or the career criminal designation, or was at least to allow the defense to argue it as part of the plea, because it's a provision that's negotiated. It might have changed the result here.
Why did Judge Quarles grant a four-level departure? Where did that come from?
It was 5K.
I know it's 5K, but why four? Why not five? Why not six? Why not three?
I can't look into Judge Quarles' mind to see why he chose that particular number. I will remind the court from the plea agreement that four was the maximum that the government was willing.
Always in Maryland. You get four as a recommendation.
Sometimes you do better.
Not on a recommendation. Office policy.
I understand that. So, in answer to...
Now, you could have moved to withdraw your guilty plea.
Yes, I could have. That has obviously other dangerous consequences.
Absolutely. I will tell you one of the things I have observed since I've been privileged to come up to this court from the district court. Unlike Maryland, all over the circuit, people plead guilty to indictments. And I've been thinking about that a lot. And I think it has to do with waiver of appeal and that kind of thing. But that's never been the practice of Maryland. But if you had moved to withdraw, at least I think you'd have a better argument on waiver, right?
I would agree. It is rare that I have either seen or considered pleading to the indictment.
It's not done in Maryland.
No.
It's done all the time in Eastern North Carolina, Middle North Carolina, Western Virginia.
I had the privilege of practicing there, so I don't know. Back to if I may for a few minutes, go back to the point that I started with, however, is the question of what is a battery insofar as a violent offense. And I would suggest to the court that...
Well, but I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but Judge Agee's right. Your principal burden here is to show why we should even look at whether the battery in this case satisfies, because you stipulate. And you couldn't convince Judge Quarles to relieve you of the stipulation.
That's true.
So the question is there any basis in law that we could enforce by requiring Judge Quarles to relieve you of the waiver? That's the real question.
The one thing I would point out, however, in the colloquy that occurred with Judge Quarles at the time that the sentencing occurred, Judge Quarles stated that he was applying a strictly categorical approach.
But it doesn't matter in light of the waiver.
Well, I still think it's a question of fundamental fairness to my client that he should have the benefit of what at least was perceived by many attorneys to be a change in the law that occurred. And also, there's the issue. You can't make somebody into a career offender if they're not.
Yes, you can, by stipulation. That's the problem.
I respectfully disagree. I don't believe that the
stipulation... So you think it's a constitutional issue?
I don't think
Quarles actually violated your client's constitutional rights by not relieving him of the stipulation?
I think that has to be our position, because I believe that, as I was saying a moment ago, and I know that the court's answer to this is...
No, well, you're the lecturer, I'm the questioner.
I know that. But the court already supplied an answer to the court's question a moment ago. But I would suggest that, as I was saying before, the sentence has to be based upon factually what is there.
And there was a factual stipulation.
There was a factual stipulation, but later the facts appeared not to be what was originally stipulated.
And so the question is, what you say you have a due process right to be relieved of a part of your plea agreement?
Yes, that is my position.
Okay.
Because quite frankly, as I was saying, but for the stipulation, you can't turn somebody into a career offender. There has to be a factual basis for it. If my client had had only one...
The factual basis is the stipulation.
I know. But if I make my, or at least try to make my point...
Is your constitutional argument in your... I know it's not in the brief.
Is it
in your opposition to the motion to dismiss?
I believe it was. I do think that... You, because of the reasons I stated before, both the fact that the number that was stipulated or the number that was agreed to that was the point of waiver never really applied in this case, and also because of, as I said before, I believe that there was a substantial change after the Johnson case. Now, I also understand that in looking back at some Fourth Circuit cases, maybe I'm not correct that it was that substantial a change, but it certainly, when the Supreme Court handed down the Johnson case, and it was specifically on the subject of a battery conviction under a very similar scenario.
You don't think it's a Marvin Mandel type of change, do you? You don't argue that Johnson decriminalized...
No.
Primary activity.
No, I do. I agree. It doesn't go to that extent. And it didn't decriminalize anything, but it did make a substantial change in how we look at the definition of the crime of battery. Maryland's case law on battery is not all that unlike Florida's. We're an old common law state, and our definition of battery has more than one way that one could commit it, and it could be merely a offensive but nonviolent touching, and that's why we believe that the battery should not have been scored for career offender purposes. I see that my time is almost out. If I may reserve the remainder and allow the government to step forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brand.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. The record in this case shows that Mr. McClain's appeal waiver was knowing and voluntary, and there is no claim to the contrary in the defendant's brief or even today. The issue he seeks to appeal, his career offender determination, is squarely covered by that appeal waiver, which provides that he will not appeal any sentencing issue under 18 U.S.C. 3742, which involves misapplication of the guidelines, if his sentence is below 327 months, and he received 168 months. Mr. McClain received substantial benefits under this plea agreement. There's no way you can objectively look at this plea agreement and say that it was in any way unfair to him. Among other things, we didn't require him to plead guilty to the drug conspiracy charge, which would have had a 10-year mandatory minimum. Now, he got above 10 years, but by pleading to count one, Mr. Hall had the opportunity certainly to argue for a sentence lower than 10 years, so that was a substantial benefit. I'll also point out that had he pled guilty to count two, even separate and apart from the career offender determination, there were other guideline enhancements that easily could have put his advisory guideline range at least, if not higher, than the level where he was at. And so really this was a negotiation like the negotiations that happen every day in our criminal justice system. Mr. Hall got the plea agreement. He signed it. Mr. McClain signed it. There was a perfectly appropriate Rule 11 colloquy. And then 9 days before the sentencing hearing, he raises this issue about the career offender enhancement. Now, as we pointed out in our brief, Johnson really was not an intervening change in the law, at least as it would be material to this case, because as Judge Davis pointed out, under Kirksey for 12 years or something like that, it had been clear what the analytical framework was for a career offender determination. But even if it had been a material change in the law, when you sign a plea agreement, you take the risk that the law might change in your favor. If he had done what, as Judge Davis says, is apparently the case in other parts of this circuit, if he had pled guilty to the indictment at sentencing, he would have been able to take advantage of whatever intervening changes of the law there had been. But he didn't plead guilty to the indictment. And that, as I said before, there were substantial benefits that accrued to him because of that decision. This court's prior decisions in Marin and Brown make clear that misapplication of the guidelines is not the type of claim that can be pursued if there is a valid knowing appeal waiver, as there was in this case. And cases like Blick and Johnson take care of the argument that an intervening change of the law can also undo the appeal waiver. Now, I feel like I should correct one thing Mr. Hall said, just so that the record is clear, and that is, I don't think Mr. Hall has seen any of the Shepard-approved documents yet in this case, because I haven't seen them. We never got them, and we don't have them. So I maybe on rebuttal he can clarify that, but I don't think we ever got them because he stipulated his career offender status.
That's one of the reasons for the stipulation, so that you don't have to go to the state archives and go hunting for records.
Well, that's right, and you know, this is a counseled guilty plea, and I think it's reasonable for the government to expect that if there's any issue, Mr. McClain remembers what he did, and perhaps, who knows, maybe he even had a copy of his old district court charging document from Somerset County, and we don't know what he has. We expect the attorneys to come back to us and say, look, there's an issue here, maybe. Maybe this was the type of very rare, but occasionally you get a nonviolent battery under Maryland law. If he had come to us, we would have had further discussions about it. Maybe we would have said, okay, we still think that a fair disposition here would be a guideline range before the 5K in that same neighborhood, and maybe we would have asked him to plead guilty to the second count and have all these other guidelines enhancements. But the plea went forward the way it did, and he has never sought to withdraw his guilty plea. He wants to get out from under one portion of the plea agreement, but not the ones that benefited him. And as we said in our 28-J letter yesterday, based on the Dickerson case that came out yesterday, that's waived. You can't do that. And the Seventh Circuit case Martinez is actually very much on point in that regard. So essentially, there really was no unfairness here, and he got the benefit of his bargain. We're just asking that we be allowed to get the benefit of our bargain as well. Those were the points I wanted to make. If the court has no further questions for me, I'd be glad to submit at this time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hall, you have some rebuttal.
Thank you. A couple of things I wanted to point out. First of all, in response to the government, there's no question under the plea agreement he did receive benefits. And I don't think that that's really so much the issue here. Of course, under a plea agreement, particularly one in which involves an issue of a 5K departure, assuming that the defendant fulfills his part of the bargain, he certainly received benefits, and there would have been detriments to pleading straight up, as Judge Davis pointed out, that we could have done. And I would suggest to the court that the fact that he could have pled straight up to and maybe put us in a better position to preserve that issue, it's really neither here nor there at this point. But as I indicated to the court, what I've always suggested in the brief is that while, yes, Kirksey certainly, I think, lays a certain amount of groundwork for the argument that that there was always a sort of a modified categorical approach, that Johnson, because it specifically dealt with the issue of the battery, made it very clear that this was an issue, and that a battery conviction, at least in some jurisdictions, and maybe it's more often the ones that are more traditionally common law, such as Maryland, where we have sort of a broad definition of battery, at least prior to the codification of first and second degree assault, that there is an issue in regard to whether or not a battery conviction would be considered a predicate offense for a career criminal designation.
Okay, Mr. Paul, excuse me for interrupting, but sure. I've been listening here and really thinking, if the court were to adopt your argument, and let's say you were a judge writing the opinion, what would you say distinguishing Blick? How would you go about doing that? Because I really haven't heard that. I've been listening to your argument, waiting for that. What basis could you put in an opinion to distinguish Blick?
Well, I think, quite frankly, that...
Because Booker was a whole lot more of a change than Johnson.
No, I understand the court's position that it is a possibly a greater change than Johnson. But I still believe that it would be a significant enough change.
Okay, would you say to distinguish Blick? The opinion that you were writing?
Because of the fact that I would suggest that Johnson was exactly on point. That's why it was significant enough to that there should be that there was that substantial a change. Johnson,
but your distinction has to be to Blick. So I want you to tell me what you're going to put in the opinion that says why Blick does not apply here.
Quite honestly, off the top of my head,
it'd be hard.
It would be. Yes, I agree. Okay. It would be. The other point I wanted to make in response to something that the government brought up, as far as the documents that at least I had access to, as I indicated, I had researched this through the state archives, so I had looked at the documents. I did not get them from the government, as the government pointed out. I understand why they would not have received them because of their waiver, but I did want to make that point clear that was something that was done in preparation for sentencing. But as The final point that I would like to make, though, is it is our position that Johnson was a significant enough change that that it obviates the appeal waiver, and therefore the court should look at this case based solely on the on whether or not the battery conviction was one that should have triggered my client's second conviction and therefore caused him to remain designated as a career offender. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. I'd like to note that you're court-appointed. Our criminal justice system could not function unless lawyers like you agreed to undertake cases such as you've done here, and court appreciates your efforts.
Thank you.
We'll come down.